From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Remember Kony 2012? The record-breaking viral video by a group called Invisible Children about a fugitive warlord who conscripted child soldiers and murdered at will. You must remember, it was only 6 weeks ago.
Posted online Monday, the video Kony 2012 by Thursday morning had 20 million views. By Friday morning, it was more than 70 million.
The Kony 2012 campaign has become a social media phenomenon. If you look at Twitter this morning, you can see that there are literally thousands of people on here just this morning posting about Kony 2012.
Is it possible that the most powerful army today is not military, but a collection of celebrities, students, and ordinary people trying to transform human rights around the globe?
Well, maybe not. Invisible Children exhorted the millions of people who watched the video to fill the streets and paper the walls with posters of the brutal Ugandan rebel on Friday, April 20th. It was to be a global cry of outrage, but it turned out to be more of a squeak. Only a handful of those people were actually mobilized. Invisible Children says its effort has been an unqualified success. Kony is still making headlines and world leaders are taking action. Ash Harwood wrote in the Council on Foreign Relations Africa in Transition blog that there's some truth in that. Ash, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Okay, so in a recent piece you wrote for the Council on Foreign Relations, you mentioned Malcolm Gladwell's New Yorker piece about social media, which he said was highly overrated as an instrument of social change,
yeah,
that it was an easy, no-risk outlet. So in this case, he seems to have been right?
I think he was right. People have referred to this as slacktivism, which basically means that it's a low-risk thing that makes you feel good about yourself. But I guess my first question is, what can you really do at the moment? Go to Uganda and search for Joseph Kony? Well, my argument would be, let's start little. This video was focused at young people. This is their first introduction to some of these issues in Africa. Admittedly, there are some problems with this as being an introduction. I mean, the lack of community involvement when it came to making the video, the very complicated political and economic context. I'm going to let the other critics handle that stuff. I mean, that stuff has been written about, and there's great resources. And I guess that comes to my point. Start with these people who have never heard of this kind of thing before, and let them get interested.
Okay, now, the guys who'd made the film wanted them to go into the streets.
Yeah.
Largely, they didn't.
Sure.
Does that have any significance?
I don't think so. I mean, anybody who organizes events kind of knows that you're not going to get a huge turnout on this stuff. I mean, I used to do events and you would hand out 100 flyers and maybe a half a person would show up for every 100 flyers. 80 million views for a topic on Africa, no matter how morbid. Wow. And for the people that did show up or go beyond just clicking the like button on Facebook, we can hope that this is the beginning of interest. When I first saw the video, I got really excited. I was like, oh man, this video has a lot of problems, but people are going to be talking about this, and there's going to be all this mobilization around people who want you to understand what's going on.
Is that how it played out, though? Has it worked as what you suggest might be a gateway drug for interest about Africa?
I think so. It's a little seed for young people who are new, and then they will hopefully go out and learn more. The high schoolers are not necessarily at this moment going to go jump on a plane and go to Uganda. But we can hope that they will spend time, for the ones who are interested, reading on the internet about this stuff.
Well, Ash, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Brooke.
Ash Harwood wrote about Kony 2012 for the Council on Foreign Relations Africa in Transition blog.
Last week, another would-be viral video about Joseph Kony was uploaded to the web by members of the United States Senate.
For millions of Americans, the Kony 2012 campaign was the first they'd heard of the LRA's terrible crimes. But many in Washington had been trying for years to get the world to notice and to act.
The 8-minute film intentionally follows the uplifting Kony 2012 template. Only instead of a good-looking young activist and his adorable little boy, this one stars John Kerry, Mary Landrieu, and James Inhofe. The video raises a number of questions. Among them, how much can the U.S. government really do about the fugitive warlord Joseph Kony? And can the U.S. government really create a viral video? Senator Chris Coons is chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on African Affairs and one of the legislators behind the video. Senator Coons, welcome to On the Media.
Great to be with you, Bob.
All right, so Charlie bit my finger. It isn't, but it is an attempt to use this new channel to capture the imagination of the online public. How did you come to this notion?
Well, Bob, as the Kony 2012 video was growing in its prominence, and as my own kids brought it to my attention and said, "What are you doing about this, Dad?" I thought that our response needed to be in kind, something that was immediate, that was accessible, that could be liked and tweeted and forwarded. We did also do a hearing on Kony and the LRA efforts of the United States government and our allies. But I frankly didn't think that a formal setting subcommittee hearing in the United States Senate was going to be as immediate or as powerful.
Has your video gotten forwarded and viewed and tweeted and all of the above?
Well, so far the video has been viewed more than 25,000 times. Senators have heard from their constituents far more broadly and far more personally on this issue than on almost anything in recent years that touches on a purely humanitarian issue in Africa. The next legislative action for the Senate is going to be a resolution. There's more than 40 co-sponsors, myself included, of a resolution supporting the administration's action and continuing the pressure for regional multilateral efforts to capture Joseph Kony and remove him from the battlefield. I've encouraged folks to go onto my website and serve as citizen co-sponsors of this resolution. And I'll be eager to see how many of the folks who watch this video join in being citizen co-sponsors of this resolution here in the Senate.
Capturing a monster and bringing him to justice, as legislative efforts go, fairly uncontroversial. I wonder if YouTube and the rest of social media as a channel for helping to create public interest behind a given legislative policy is going to continue with much more, politically fraught initiatives in the future. Are senators going to be making their case on Twitter and Instagram, or continue to do it in the well of the Senate?
Well, Bob, I think we need to do both. Our constituents are communicating with us by email, by Facebook, on Twitter. Those are the tools that modern Americans use to communicate with each other, to express their opinions, and to engage in their communities. The Congress of the United States is struggling with a very low public regard and is at risk of being even more irrelevant, even more disconnected from our constituents if we don't participate in the conversation and the dialogue and respond. So while I expect we will still be giving speeches on the floor of the Senate, we will still hold hearings, we will still deliberate in the time-honored ways of this Congress, we also need to demonstrate to our own constituents that we're capable of participating in the modern online communication that is reshaping the American community and reshaping the American political future.
Senator, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate having a chance to be on.
Senator Chris Coons is the chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on African Affairs. In Uganda, a group of local journalists also released a YouTube video in response to Kony 2012. The project is called Uganda 2012. Its video is much less polished than those produced by Invisible Children in the U.S. Senate. At the end of the week, it had just 3,900 YouTube views.
Our vision is to change Ugandan stories. We want Ugandan stories told and voices heard. In this video, you will see some of the stories of people in northern Uganda in response to the Kony 2012 video.
Uganda 2012 contributor Rosabel Kagamir says that the group prefers a few viewers interested in the truth rather than millions casually consuming a simplistic and misleading story about her country.
Uganda suffered so much in terms of loss of lives, but also loss of economy. We didn't have tourists coming here, but now we have recovered. And if we have a movie being watched by 100 million people, which kind of shows that there's a war in Uganda, we were worried that that was going to have a big impact.
Invisible Children's video was very slick, but more to the point, it had a very compelling narrative. Your video has had very, very few views. And I wonder if that's because it isn't very slick, and it sure isn't, or whether there's some other element is missing.
In the Kony 2012, you have this good guy from America and his kid fighting this bad African guy. So it's easy to make people emotionally charged about some bad guy that they've just learned about. We are looking for people to understand that this war is not just emotional. The war is also about which other actors have taken part in it. Most people, for example, in northern Uganda, when the film was shown, they said, who the hell would wake up and wear Joseph Kony's name? A shirt of a mass murderer. We are not looking to raise up emotions. We are looking to get thoughtful contributions to end this war.
When your group began to discuss what to do next, was there debate as to whether even to acknowledge the existence of Kony 2012? Or did some say, no, let's use this opportunity? Others say, oh, how can we even dignify it with a reference? I mean, what was the conversation?
This campaign came because it was in response, but it's not limited to that. So the whole Kony 2012 was about capture Kony. But we are concentrating on victims of the war and what they are struggling with and what they hope their future to be.
What do you believe deserves the world's greatest focus?
You know, just like any other war in Africa, once the war has ended, organizations just pack their bags and go, and then forget that people have to pick up pieces. You know, the whole entire system was broken down by the war. So people are slowly starting to build systems which are not good enough yet to support them, especially education, health. You know, there's a major disease now called the nodding disease.
This is a neurological disease that affects children between 5 and 15.
Yes, and we have over 2,000 children across northern Uganda facing this disease that has no cure. The response was really slow, both from Ugandan government and from agencies that are working on health. So really, people of northern Uganda have very serious problems that the world can really help.
In the end, though, in a funny way, Rose Bell, in terms of calling attention to the actual problems in northern Uganda, do you not owe a certain debt to invisible children and the very documentary that you so despise?
I think that it's absurd that people who can afford to tell the story correctly choose to tell it the wrong way. So for us, we are here to do that. And if they had been perfect, maybe we wouldn't have spoken. So I don't owe anything to invisible children.
Rose Bell, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rose Bell Kagamir is a journalist in Kampala.
Coming up, the many ways reporters in war zones don't know how to protect themselves or their sources.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
Hi, this is On the Media producer Alex Goldman. And I'm OTM producer PJ Vogt and Alex's best friend. That's not true, you just wrote it into the script. And the reason we're here is that us producers were talking about why we don't show up higher in the podcast rankings on iTunes.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, in order to get good Apple juju, you need to get reviews on your podcast. Relative to our listener base, we don't have that many reviews.
I've got a supplemental theory.
Okay.
There's some not-so-great reviews up there. Like this one from Mr. Gator OK. Subject: National Propaganda Radio. Review: Communist feel-good patriot bashing radio. You poor, subverted, useful lemmings.
Yeah, well, that could have something to do with it.
Can I just do one more?
Yeah.
Review: I learned more by listening to Dog Soup, and it's about dogs.
Look, I just know that there are more people we could be reaching that don't know about our show because we're just not high enough in the rank.
So we need to tell people to, if they like the show, go to the iTunes store and give us good reviews.
Come on, guys. Do it for Bob and Brooke.
What are you doing in here?
Nothing.
Leave me out of this.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Journalists confront any number of obstacles and conflict zones, threats to their own safety, the inability to report freely, a firewall of propaganda. And now with reporters' increased reliance on new technology comes a new hazard: mortal danger to themselves and their sources due to weak or non-existent digital security measures. Journalist Matthew Akins wrote about the problem for the May issue of the Columbia Journalism Review, and he included some chilling case studies, including the story of British filmmaker Sean McAllister and a Syrian dissident source who went by the online name of Kardok.
Kardok was very eager to get the word out about the dissidents in Syria, so he was willing to work with Sean, but he became very worried because of surveillance by the Syrian government. And he wasn't sure that Sean was following the kind of safety precautions that he and his fellow activists felt were necessary in these situations. He said that Sean was using unencrypted emails and calling him on the phone and sending mobile text and generally just not behaving in a way that someone who may be the subject of intense electronic surveillance needs to behave.
And sure enough, Sean was arrested and Cardell fled the country immediately.
He didn't hesitate. He just packed his bag, turned off his phone, and fled, and eventually ended up across the border in Lebanon, where he's living underground now. A number of other sources either fled or were arrested. So they were obviously compromised because the Syrians were able to get the information on Sean's computer and phone because they weren't properly encrypted. Reporters are sort of a one-stop shop for information for spies, right? We're doing all the hard work, contacting dissidents, investigating stories, and they can access all that just by getting into our computers or email addresses, where we're storing most of this information these days.
How much are these countries able to do in penetrating a reporter's work?
Western companies and Chinese companies and other companies have been selling this kind of repressive technology to all these different governments. Nokia or Amesis, which is a French company, there's Blue Code. There's really no restrictions on this sort of thing right now, so it's been a free-for-all. It's very powerful surveillance technology, and it'll allow you to monitor all the email and phone conversations that are taking place within a country. It's really incredible how easy it's gotten for governments to be able to do this stuff. And of course, the U.S. government can do that too, but there are legal protections, and those technologies, when they're used in a place like Bahrain or Syria, are used to target anyone indiscriminately.
You also discovered some pretty chilling information about the extent to which reporters were exposed in Libya. You describe a guy named Marwan Arabi, who was in charge of information technology at Libya's Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Marwan told me about how, among many other news organizations, they'd accessed a CNN journalist's email account and actually downloaded a source list with phone numbers and names of people who were secretly in contact with CNN inside Tripoli during the war. Arabi was secretly in contact with the Libyan opposition, and so he tried to warn some of the people on this list.
Describe the Trojan horse virus.
Well, a Trojan horse virus gets accepted onto your computer in the guise of something else. So someone sends you a video. Hey, look at this video of human rights abuses by Gaddafi forces. And when you click on it, it actually installs a file on your computer that allows people to access and do whatever they want to you, basically. Once you control someone else's email account, then it becomes much easier to hack into their friends because you can pretend to be that person and they'll be more likely to trust a file that you send them.
And yet Arabi told you that it isn't that this stuff is so complicated.
I mean, this is stuff that a 14-year-old kid can do. I mean, there's a lot that you can do to protect yourself. Encrypt your drive, which basically means that all the data is in a code that only someone who has a password can read.
And you don't use passwords like 12345?
Which is what half of the Syrian government officials who were hacked were apparently using. Using long and complex passwords, being careful about what you click on and download. These are all important basic steps that people can take to secure themselves.
Every reporter understands the need to protect their sources. That's not something you have to drive home.
Well, I think it's kind of a generational thing. Technology has crept up so fast that now you're asking a lot of experienced, established reporters to stop their workflow and learn a whole new language. Right now, there's really not much in the way of comprehensive programs to teach people digital security anywhere, whether it's at news organizations or at journalism schools.
It seems like a problem so fundamental, they should have begun to address it before now.
Probably in 10 years, we'll look back and think, wow, it was crazy. We were walking around with our whole digital lives hanging out there exposed, and we didn't take basic precautions. And the sooner people wake up, the better, because I'll tell you, hackers and spies have already woken up to it, and right now it's a feeding frenzy for them. It's all out there, and they are loving it.
Matthew, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Matthew Akins is a freelance journalist. His piece, "The Spy Who Came In from the Code," can be seen in the May issue of the Columbia Journalism Review. Last year, more journalists died covering political unrest than any year on record, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Two of them, covering the Libyan uprising, were seasoned war photographers Chris Hondros and Tim Hetherington. Among Hetherington's many assignments, he'd recently spent much of a year embedded with a platoon of U.S. soldiers deployed to a remote, very dangerous outpost in Afghanistan, an assignment he shared with fellow conflict reporter and friend Sebastian Younger. When Younger learned that Hetherington's mortal injury could have been treated, he marked the anniversary of his and Hondros' death by founding a new organization called Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues, or RISC, to train freelance reporters in life-saving. Its first session took place last week in New York. Sebastian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So first, tell me what you thought happened to Tim Hetherington a year ago and what you learned since.
What I was told is that a mortar fired by Gaddafi forces exploded in the midst of a group of rebel fighters and journalists. And Chris Hondros was hit in the head by shrapnel and rendered unconscious immediately, and it was a mortal wound. Tim was hit in the groin, and so he was fully conscious, but he was losing a lot of blood. And over the course of the next 10 minutes or so, he lost so much blood that he died in the back of a pickup truck as the rebels were racing him back towards a hospital to be treated. And I sort of assumed that an arterial bleed in the groin is, you know, basically a death sentence. But a combat medic told me that not necessarily. There are things you can do to slow down the blood loss even in a situation like that. And all they had to do was prolong his life by 5 minutes just to get him to the hospital. And that maybe if the journalists around him had known some battlefield medicine, that they might have been able to keep him alive.
You knew him incredibly well. What kind of training did he have?
Oh, none. Nobody does. I mean, no freelancers do.
You? Did you have any?
No. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. I don't know anyone who's had any formal medical training. I mean, I think the insurance companies require that the media organizations train the people they have who are on salary. But freelancers, no. And so I know this from when I was in the field. We all have a kind of slightly fatalistic attitude, like, okay, well, if it happens, it happens. But meanwhile, let's go get the story. And I just thought I needed to start a nonprofit that would train freelancers for free.
How do you pay for that?
Well, initially, I went to the news organizations that Chris Hondros and Tim Hetherington worked for, to Vanity Fair, Condé Nast, to CNN, to Getty, to the Chris Hondros Foundation established by his fiancée, to National Geographic and ABC News. And they donated very generously, and we were able to do the first training program. Now we're going after real corporate money. We want to try to bring the program to the freelancers just to alleviate the travel costs for them.
War reporting seems to have shifted towards freelancers, hasn't it?
Well, the economics of it are a little bit more favorable for the news organizations. You're not paying someone's salary. You're not paying their insurance. You're really not responsible for them. You're buying their work product, which is a great deal for the news organizations. And frankly, it's a great deal for the freelancers as well.
How?
The looseness of it allows anyone who's motivated and ambitious and courageous and has a good camera to simply go to Libya during the war, hook up with the rebels, take images, and hope to sell them. And that's a real shortcut compared to the kind of career ladder you have to climb if you're just grinding your way through a salaried version of all that. Mm-hmm. That's a lifelong process. This you can do in 6 months.
So what's the balance that needs to be struck so that freelancers can be safer and yet news organizations can afford to hire them?
I think what news organizations might do is strongly encourage freelancers to get health insurance, life insurance, bulletproof vest and a helmet, and to have medical equipment and to be properly trained in battlefield medicine.
You said encourage freelancers to do that, not require them to do that, or not pay for them to do that.
I think it's a matter of the culture.
Not just the culture at a professional news organization that wants to save money on insurance, but the culture of the young, cocky war reporter that believes in his or her own invulnerability.
You're not going to change the cockiness of youth. That's thousands of years old, and thank God it's there. But what I would say is that 20 years ago, this wasn't true. But now, having a bulletproof vest and a helmet is a mark of professionalism. And you show up on a battlefield without any of that gear, and you just look like a jerk. every freelancer wants to look professional. And if the culture of freelance journalism starts to move away from that sort of cavalier fatalism towards, listen, we should all be trained so that, God forbid, one of us gets hit, we all know what to do. It's a kind of caretaking thing. And at least two of the people who were in the program, there were 24 students, two of them had already been wounded on the battlefield. They're way more mature than I was in my early 30s when I first went off to do this.
So, best case scenario?
The best case scenario for me is that, I mean, there's going to be another Tim, and maybe that person will be saved by someone who we've instructed, and then his friends or her friends and family don't go through what we all went through when Tim died and Chris died.
Other than creating risk, what impact did Tim's death have on your work?
Me making the decision not to cover combat anymore. I didn't want to put the people I care about through the experience that he had put me through. I'm 50 years old. I feel like one of the duties of being a fully mature person is to not inflict pain on people you love. And that's not quite true at 30, but at 50, it starts to be pretty true. And I want to make sure I never did that.
Sebastian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sebastian Younger is author, most recently, of War. He co-directed Restrepo with Tim Hetherington, and he's just founded Risk, Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues, which we'll link to on our website.
Once, quite a while back, I was talking with an employee of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He ended the conversation by informing me that, quote, if you have any questions, you can reach me telephonically. Telephonically? That's government speak for give me a call. And if the government can't talk straight, it writes even worse. Your average communique from the government is packed with legalese, obfuscations, and general abuse of the English language. It's so bad that the government chose to regulate itself with the Plain Writing Act of 2010. The act stipulates that executive branch documents should be written in plain, understandable language. Dr. Annetta Cheek is the founder and chair of the Center for Plain Language that pushed for the passage of the act. A former writer of regulations herself, Cheek took up the cause after chancing upon a single revelatory document.
At one point, I was introduced by a colleague to a reg that he was working on about offshore oil and gas leasing, and I knew absolutely nothing about the topic, but I was able to understand the regulation, which was almost at that time sort of against the law, that you could understand a federal regulation that you knew nothing about. And it was one of those aha moments. Since then, I've become sort of fanatic. You know, why can't all federal regulations be written this clearly?
Let's talk for a moment about what we are up against. I'm going to read you a regulation from the National Park Service. In its original form, it sounded like this. When the process of freeing a stuck vehicle that has been stuck results in ruts or holes, the operator will fill the rut or hole created by such activity before removing the vehicle from the immediate area.
Right.
The rewritten version sounds like this. If you make a hole while freeing a stuck vehicle, you must fill the hole before you drive away. That's better.
It certainly is, but it's very hard to get from that first version to the second version.
And where does this come from, this impenetrable bureaucratese? Is it cultural? Is there a legal underpinning to it?
Yes and yes. My background's in anthropology, and to me, it is part of the government culture. It sounds formal. It sounds official. And, of course, there is a legal aspect. Attorneys for the government are always very concerned about making sure that their regulation can stand up in court. And they really aren't concerned about the person who has to read the regulation and implement it.
In fulfillment of your grand vision for clarity in government language came the Plain Writing Act of 2010, which I guess is good news, but there's a bad news part of this. There was a piece in the Washington Post that estimated that there's only at this stage 10% compliance. Does that sound about right to you?
Maybe it's overly optimistic.
Yikes. I want to ask you about backlash. You know, when they rewrote the Lord's Prayer to make it more accessible to 20th century speakers, it ruffled some feathers because it just didn't sound ecclesiastical enough.
Right.
Is there a chance that there will be resistance to the kind of clarity and straightforwardness that you so prize?
Absolutely. Most of it will come from the writers. I don't think too much of it would come from the reader, even though maybe some people in the government think that they are deities. I don't think most of the public feels that. A little anecdote, back in the late Clinton administration, we were trying to get people in the White House to agree to a plain language style guide for executive orders. Executive orders tend to be particularly impenetrable. But then the attorney who reviewed these said, oh, we cannot write presidential executive orders in plain language because it's not magisterial.
I will assert that sometimes there is poetry in gobbledygook. I'm going to read perhaps the most famous paragraph in American governmental language. It goes like this. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another, and to assume the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Now that's from the Declaration of Independence, Annetta.
Right. Right.
Our producer, Chris Neary, rewrote that trying to channel you. And here's what he came up with. It's time to break free from England because it's our God-given right to do that. We're every bit as good as they are, but it's only fair we explain why we got to do this thing. It sounds pretty unmagisterial.
It's hard to evaluate writing from that long ago in today's context because that was more normal writing back then than, it would be now. On the other hand, I think if the government were writing that paragraph today, it would have a lot more words.
Do you think John Adams was standing over Thomas Jefferson's shoulder and saying, dude, it doesn't sound quite pompous enough. Throw in another equal station.
Possibly.
Annetta, thank you very much.
You're certainly welcome. I love talking about plain language. I'll do it anytime.
Annetta Cheek is the founder and chair of the Center for Plain Language, which is staging a Plain Language in Law conference in Washington, D.C., May 21st to 23rd at the National Press Club.
Coming up, truth matters, even when it's about Rangelina. Also, an algorithm that predicts how long they'll stay married.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In Britain this week, the Leveson inquiry into the News Corp phone hacking scandal continues, with Rupert Murdoch and his son James back on the stand. The week's big revelation was a trove of 163 emails released by the Murdochs between a News Corp lobbyist and one of the culture minister's closest aides. The trove dates back to News Corp's bid for B Sky B, a failed acquisition which would have granted the company an even stronger monopoly over British media. The emails detail confidential conversations among regulators and with lobbyists for News Corp about the Murdoch bid, suggesting a cozy relationship between the British government and News Corp. The email release seemed designed to guarantee mutually assured destruction, causing havoc for David Cameron's government, which would very much prefer not to be associated with the disgraced Murdoch clan. And yet, despite all the evidence to the contrary, on the stand, Rupert Murdoch sought to portray himself as a political naif, a kindly old ink-stained wretch.
You know, I have to admit that some newspapers are closer to my heart than others, but I also have to say that I failed.
Peter Jukes is reporting on the trial for the Daily Beast. He says that Murdoch's protestations are undercut by his political side games.
So you have a statement and an action totally at odds with each other.
Add to the web of circumstantial evidence visits literally through the back door of 10 Downing Street. And most deliciously, the report from a Daily Telegraph reporter, Ian Martin. Tell me what Ian Martin has written.
There was a case where Jeremy Hunt, who was potentially going to be a senior cabinet minister dealing with communications as the culture minister, was invited to a News Corp party, and a Telegraph journalist saw him hiding behind a tree because he was trying to get to meet to James Murdoch and didn't want journalists to see it. You know, that's what you have to court them, but not to be seen to be courting them. That's the image. There's another, Rupert talked about this, where he, I think within about 2 weeks of David Cameron entering number 10, Rupert comes in, but by the back door. So he said, I often came in the back door. And he added in the Leveson Inquiry, maybe that's because it's slightly nearer my apartment.
Yeah, he was just taking the shortcut. As it turns out, that may be exactly what was taking place.
I mean, the optics of it are not good because we talk about back doors and back channels. There's one more image which may haunt the Prime Minister even more in the weeks to come, because we have to remember we still have evidence from Rebecca Brooks, who was the CEO of News International, that News International were deemed to be slightly close to the police and whining and dining them during this whole phase, and they should have been investigating phone hacking. It emerged that a police horse had been lent to Rebecca Brooks. This horse was returned in rather bad condition a year or so later, ridden too much. And one of its riders was David Cameron. And this is called Horsegate, inevitably. And the connections still might return to damage beyond Cameron himself.
One of the odd twists to this is that to the extent that Murdoch was cozying up to David Cameron, the cozying seems to be over. On his own Twitter feed, Murdoch has been quite hostile to Cameron and seems to have pretty much turned against him. What's going on?
Well, it's funny, isn't it? The proprietor of the world's third biggest media conglomerate has to take to social media to get his voice heard. I think there's some irony there. And yes, for the last 3 months, his main target, David Cameron, figures time and time again.
I don't understand what there is for Murdoch to gain.
This is the bizarre question, isn't it? Because, of course, he can do great damage by revealing these back channels to the Conservative-led government. But actually, mud sticks both ways. News Corp, they don't come out of it well either. So I think this is a slight act of desperation.
In your coverage in the Daily Beast, you suggested this could be the beginning of the end for the whole Murdoch empire, at least in the UK. And it doesn't bode well for the coalition government and David Cameron. Tell me how this is all going to shake out.
There's a difference between the Murdoch empire and News Corp, though obviously on paper they have all the voting power. I think News Corp will survive. The dynasty is over. James will no longer succeed as chair and CEO of News Corp.
And Cameron.
I'm in divided opinion. I will happily place myself on the left, center-left. I'm not sure I want a newspaper proprietor, no matter how angry, to bring down my elected government. Despite, you know, my reservations about Cameron, the government, I would like that to be determined by the British people in the ballot box, not by the back door and a newspaper proprietor.
Now, you happen to be from England.
From Britain, please. There's no such nation as England.
You had a writer there a few centuries back, named Shakespeare. As you watch Murdoch...
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day, Bob?
No. How about King Lear? Disappointing children, under assault, raving. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I did write a piece for the Daily Beast about his tweets. They reminded me of King Lear on the heath. I shall do such things. I don't know what they shall be, but they shall be the terror of all the earth. And he was saying, I will have my revenge coming soon. It will be brutal. You know, those kind of tweets. There is something Shakespearean and tragic about Murdoch, and something quite magnificent in some way. And he will leave the stage at some point, probably not too distant future. And in some ways, there will be a loss in public life.
Peter, many thanks.
Thanks, Bob.
Peter Jukes has covered the Murdoch scandal for the Daily Beast. He's working on a book called Bad Press, Fall of the House of Murdoch.
Obviously, some facts are more important than others. You need to know the truth about the functioning of government and the state of our defenses, right? But do you need to know that...
Hollywood's most loved couple split. That according to In Touch Weekly. The magazine, on stands Friday, citing an insider, wrote, quote, after 13 years of marriage, Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith have decided to separate.
That clip we just heard was Entertainment Tonight. Michael Lewitis, how would you describe Entertainment Tonight reporting on In Touch?
In this instance, it's a matter of the blind leading the blind.
Michael Lewitis is the co-founder and editor of GossipCop.com. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you have this site which got about 3 million unique views in February. That's a lot more than PolitiFact or FactCheck.org. Okay, so people are more interested in celebrities than politicians. But what's interesting to me is that the stakes are so much smaller when it comes to the future of the marriage of Will and Jada than about the future of national health care.
You're comparing apples to oranges here, yes.
Yes, that's so unfair.
But I think everyone deserves to know the truth, whether it's sports or business or politics or their interpersonal relationships. You don't want to be deceived.
Is it true?
No, it's not true. It started off with they're going to separate. She's met with a divorce attorney. She moved out. As months and months go by, well, they're still perfectly happy together.
What's your professional experience?
Well, I worked at the New York Daily News as a gossip columnist. I then went off to the New York Post, where I was the entertainment editor for the weekends. And then I went to Us Weekly, where I was the news director. And then I produced Access Hollywood. So I've been in this business 15 years, almost 20.
What drives you?
It's funny. When I was in college, I was interested in anthropology. I went to study other cultures, and it ended up that the culture that I started to study were celebrities and the way that they live.
Do you consider them inscrutable island people?
They're an interesting breed. They live among us, but they live differently.
Don't most people think this stuff is pretty much made up anyway?
You know, they're selling millions of magazines, and if they think it's made up, well, why would you buy it?
To project, to imagine what it would be like to be them, to follow narratives regardless of their veracity?
I think they take a much more simplified view of it, and they go, oh, well, this magazine told me that's true. Well, then I believe it.
You're a gossip reporter who's seriously into gossip and seriously into reporting. In the ensuing decade and a half, celebrity blogs have taken over a lot of that function. Is your fact-check site a desire, in a sense, to get back to the day when people did engage in real fact-checking?
Absolutely. When I started out, if you got a story wrong, you'd get in trouble, and if it was really bad, you'd get fired.
Come on.
Absolutely. Now these people start blogs who were never reporters, but they think, oh, this would be really cool to write about celebrities. They don't have sources. They hear things, or they're regurgitating things that they've seen in magazines and embellishing it. There's no fact-checking at all. It becomes this crazy echo chamber of rumor, and it spreads, and then by the time it gets to the third or fourth blog, it's a completely outrageous story.
You strike me as an interesting case, Michael, and here's why. You have the ethics and the values of a straight news reporter. On the other hand, you're also using the technique that you've honed over 15 years, which is not to cite your sources and to simply be known to your readers as a trustworthy source.
As you said, some of the standards are a little different when it comes to celebrity reporting. I wish I could get both celebrities to tell me, it's not true, I'm not leaving my wife, it's not true, my husband hasn't left me. But unfortunately, in the entertainment world, it doesn't really work that way. Unlike politics, there isn't really a policy issue here. It's really about personal relationships, and people don't like talking about their personal lives on the record. Will they talk about it on background? Sure.
Is it ever frustrating to find yourself day after day engulfed in the rumored squabbles of celebrity couples or minor arrests or altercations in bars or who knows what?
You know, it's almost like that line from The Godfather, this is the life I chose. You know, I get this question because sometimes people do a little background check and they see the pedigree and they go, really, did you go to Yale for this? I started as a reporter because I was interested in becoming a reporter and finding out the truth. My beat happened to have been celebrities. You might as well be the best you can at whatever your beat is, whether you're chasing down fires, you're working in the cop shop, or you're covering celebrities.
Do you think I'm a horrible public radio snob?
Your job is to ask the tough questions. And my job is to do the best reporting. And the two of us are right here, you know, in the midst of how do you reconcile the tough questions about celebrity reporting?
Michael, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Michael Lewitis is the co-founder and editor of GossipCop.com.
A few years ago, statistician Garth Sundom and journalist John Tierney published an equation that predicted the shelf life of a celebrity marriage. Love is complicated, and appropriately, the equation included a lot of variables, like each member of the couple's amount of fame, their relative level of attractiveness, the length of their courtship, etc., etc. But recently, Sundom and Tierney announced that they'd found a way to make their formula simpler and more accurate. They decided to focus on just five factors. The first two seem obvious, months spent dating and combined ages at times of marriage. The third is a little surprising, the amount of skin the bride shows in the first page of her Google image results. The fourth and fifth, Garth Sundom explains, involve a very simple metric to measure the quality of the bride's media attention and, consequently, the duration of marital bliss.
The ratio of her mentions in the New York Times to her mentions in the Inquirer. It doesn't matter how few or how many total Google hits they have. If the flavor of her fame is tabloid fame, then it predicts a short marriage.
How are you doing with the newly formulated unified theory?
Some of the predicted long couples, Chelsea Clinton and Mark Mizvinsky, she has stayed surprisingly out of the Inquirer while getting a ton of New York Times mentions. They have a 52.7% chance of making it 15 years.
Which is, I should observe, greater than the general population.
52.7% chance of making it 15 years on this celebrity marriage list puts them among the all-stars, who also include Kate Middleton and Prince William. Now, she's been in the tabloids a ton, but she's balanced it out with New York Times mentions, and they've been dating since college, and that predicts marital longevity to the tune of 64.3% to make it 15 years. Also, Beyoncé Knowles and Jay-Z are an extremely strong couple based mostly on the fact that they've dated forever. So that's the top of the list. Those are the couples to beat in celebrity marriage.
Okay, so I have this image. It is the year 2073.
Okay.
We're in an assisted living home on the west coast of Florida, and I'm scanning the room, and I'm wondering, who will I categorically not find there? Together, that is.
You won't find Khloe Kardashian and Lamar Odom. The flavor of her fame is terrible. They're young. They didn't date very long before getting married. I give them exactly 0% chance of making it 15 years.
And yet,
30-plus months, and still – KK and Lamar Odom continue on. They are currently defying the laws of man, nature, and mathematics, and good for them.
Okay. I want to ask you about Brangelina.
Yeah.
Because they have been together a long time, but...
But not married.
Although I'm told they're engaged.
Oh, yes.
What's going to happen with them?
Okay, let's go back into the past, into the days just after the Aniston split.
I'm sorry, I hate to do this, but I have to jump in here to say that the Aniston split is not some sort of like statistical constant. It's a reference to Jennifer Aniston and Brad
yes.
Pitt breaking up.
Yes, neither is it a dessert. If Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt had married just after the Aniston split, they would have had a 1% chance of making it 15 years. The flavor of her fame at that point was very tabloid heavy. She had smoking hot Google image hits. And they were both a little younger and they hadn't dated very long. Now, if they got married this month, they would have a 51% chance of making it 15 years. Now, here's why, and this is kind of cool. Angelina Jolie's Google image hits are now much more cocktail dress than lingerie. So the overt sexiness of her Google image hits is down. She's gotten a lot of legit press. She is mentioned 1,083 times in the New York Times compared to 378 times in the Inquirer, which is a pretty darn good ratio.
All right, dude, I got one more question for you. Even though we're talking about celebrities, they are still arguably human beings.
Yes.
Do you find yourself, when your predictions are on the verge of coming to naught, do you find yourself rooting for a breakup? Do you find yourself lingering in the checkout aisle?
No.
Come on.
So first of all, I will say that this is correlative and not causative. So far, I have been unable to influence the duration of a celebrity marriage. Oh, do I root for people to break up? No. No, I can't do that. I root for them to beat my math. It just doesn't happen.
Garth, I want to thank you not only for joining us, but just for your work.
I know. I hope I can shine some light and bring some meaning to some lives around the country and the world, really.
Well, you've touched one man, I'm going to tell you that. Garth Sundom is the author of Brain Trust, 93 Top Scientists Reveal Lab-Tested Secrets to Surfing, Dating, Dieting, Gambling, Growing Man-Eating Plants, and More. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Rob Schoon and Louisa Beck, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
And Bob, judging from the amount of skin in your Google image results, this marriage isn't long for this world.
Thank God. Thank God.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.